You're not gonna say it, somebody should. Let's talk about two time. Let's talk about bum one, yeah. Asking the questions that nobody could. Like, where are the bone thugs and are they in harmony? You're a helpful snowman.
Hey, everybody. Well, welcome to this episode. I kind of thought that for this episode, I'd sit behind someone who refuses to use their turn signal. No, I just saw this thing online. It was, I think, I don't want to credit the wrong person, but I think it was the Roman Mars guy, 99% invisible guy. I can't remember if it was him or not, but it was someone who's like big in the podcast world, right? And he was saying, don't spend your money on better equipment. Spend more time editing your podcast. Because, you know, if you save 10 minutes from your, or cut 10 minutes out of your show, and then you save, you know, 1,000 people 10 minutes, that's 10,000 minutes, blah, blah, blah. Which I was like, hey, go fuck yourself. But also, it was just funny because I'm looking at some equipment. To make an upgrade. Although I gotta say, it's like, I've been rocking the same shit for 400 plus episodes now, so maybe it's time for a little upgrade, a little nicer. Anyway. I did want to talk about a topic that's near and dear to my heart. And also, because I actually got asked a question about something, about how I feel about something in real life, which made me think, yeah, maybe people will care what I think about it and should talk about it on a podcast. And the topic is basically fiction writing from a place of lived experience. So this is kind of a debate that's happening. There was an article, I think, in the New York Times or New Yorker, some New York thing, which that's how you know it's serious. I really think I should start a magazine and just call it, like, the New York Stir, the New York Timeliness or something, you know, just have New York in it, the New York Gazette, some shit like that, because then people will be like, But, you know, they'll say like, well, why the diminutive Gazette? Can't you just do a guz? What's the Gazette? What's that all about? But I think that there was an article about it, and it was specifically about young adult literature, because there's this problem happening in young adult literature where there, it's within the genre, within, you know, the writers and publishers, because they're talking about writing from lived experience, and how that creates some problems, but it's how some people feel writing should be done. And so what that means, like, in the most basic term is, like, I probably shouldn't write, for example, a black male character because I wouldn't do it authentically. That's what the most militant person on the side of that would say. Someone who's less militant would say, well, you shouldn't write it unless you have, you know, a black male person to consult with and to make sure it sounds authentic. And then someone on the other side says something different. And so in the article, they talked to a couple different authors and people in that world, and I thought that one of the people interviewed was a young woman, and she kind of said, I just don't think this is necessarily a useful way to talk about literature. And I think that she's correct. And, you know, this is the question I was asked is, so what do you think? Do you think that, like, people should only write from lived experience? Should they do other things and so on? And I'll say, too, most of the writing I've done is from lived experience. I mean, it's not, as far as culture and that kind of thing, I've never tried to write a story about, like, a Native American boy growing up in modern society, or, you know, I've never really, the people that I've written culturally or as far as identifiers are similar to myself. It's not coming from a defensive place for me. I'm not like, oh, I did this, and so now I kind of have to talk about how I feel about that I did it. It's more of a hypothetical, which is, I guess, to me seems good as far as it being a hypothetical. I think there are people who would say that's not good, because it's like, maybe I don't have enough skin in the game here. But I think it's like, on the one hand, I don't have like a defensive feeling about it. And on the other hand, I don't have like a wounded feeling, because it's like, well, I read such and such and it was a terrible depiction of my kind of person. By which I mean someone who's like me, not like, he's my kind of guy. Although I will say this, as far as like authentically and then seeing people who I can identify with, I know there are a lot of like middle-age-ish straight white dudes on like sitcoms, but they are not people that I can identify with for various reasons. They're all like idiot dads who you're like, how have you survived this long? Or they're like, you know, fat party animals turned to usually dumb dads, or at least out of it husbands who are always trying to pull some wacky scheme or something. And it's like, my wacky schemes have been pretty tame, and I don't know if I've ever tried to do a wacky scheme under the nose of, like, Poon Master Flex. I mean, I think it's a sign of maybe not such a good relationship if you feel like in order to do the things you want in your relationship, you have to do it via wacky scheme. That might not be a good sign. I might lightly, humbly suggest that that's not a very good relationship. Because if it's something you want to do, you should be able to talk to your spouse about it and do it above board. And if your spouse is disallowing you from doing things that are, like, reasonable, I mean, I'm not saying your spouse has to be like, you're right, let's kill people and then take their ears and put them in a baggie and then freeze-dry them into jerky. You know, if that's your thing, then yes, your spouse is probably not wrong for whatever. Anyway, point being, I'm not wounded by the question or by this, nor have I... Okay, so I've seen, like, the dads, right? I've seen the sitcom dads. I've seen the bad depictions of people like me, which it totally exist, right? But they don't hurt me. Like, I don't feel hurt by them. I don't feel, like, infuriated by them. I just, you know, they exist. So I haven't been hurt by this, nor do I feel like I've hurt someone in doing it. So I guess that's what makes me... But I am very interested in writing and storytelling and the creation of that kind of material. So I do feel like maybe this puts me in a position to have a perspective on it that not everyone would share or not everyone would have. Or I've put probably more thought into it than somebody who just doesn't really care about this shit. So here we go. My thoughts on it overall. Kind of thesis statement would be a good place to start, right? Would have been a smart thing to prepare and then just have ready to go. That's what a smart podcaster would have done. That's what Roman Mars would have done. Or he would be like, just cut this out and just pretend like you did. But I'm like, well, that's a goddamn lie. Also, Roman Mars, I feel like what you're promoting is like an old version of media, which is like professional, polished, and that's kind of what it rides on. Where I feel like the new media world is a little bit more amateurish. Or, you know, the things like editing and that kind of stuff aren't as apparent. And the differences in quality aren't as apparent, and it's more like day in the life type of thing than a hard-hitting news story about fucking whatever they talk about on 99% Invisible. Buildings? Stairs? Reading a sign on a historical thing? I actually think that's a good show, but he just pissed me off. You know, that's an example of something I'm defensive about, as opposed to this. which is why I keep talking against it. Okay, so general thesis statement. I don't agree with the idea. And there's kind of a base level in which I don't agree with the idea, and then there's sort of an additional level where I see where people who feel that way are coming from, and I see what they're saying, and I don't completely disagree with them, but I think that it causes other problems that I think are more urgent, or more difficult than it solves problems. Okay. So let's start off with this. I think from a purely, one of the problems I see it causes is there's a big movement for diversity in literature, right? But I think if people can only write from lived experience, it's going to be difficult for others to see themselves in books. Because let's be honest, if you take a population that is, let's take a real life example. I read a comic that was about a bisexual Latinx, is about a bisexual Latinx superhero, right? And that's how she identified and so on. So they found a bisexual Latinx writer for it. And the book was bad. And I'm pretty sure I talked about it on here before, so I'm not going to get too into it. And like, okay, this is not me saying like, well, obviously there's not any good bisexual Latinx writers. But here's what I want to say. Let's say 50% of the population is Latinx, whether that means they identify as Latinx, Latina, Latino, whatever, right? I'm going to be generous the whole way through because I think the point's still valid, right? So half. So we're down to 50% of the population. Then you go, okay, cut that in half because this person's female. So then you cut that in half, and you got 25% of the population. Now let's talk bisexual. So like high numbers, you know, seems like people would say 10% is kind of somewhere in the range of an agreed upon number as far as people saying gay, right? 10% is about right. So I'm going to just include that as the number that's, you know, queer, let's just call it, in some way or another. And realistically, I think the bisexual population is probably less than 10%, right? But let's call it that for now. So right now, we're down to 2.5% of the population as potential people who could write these books. Now, let's take that percent. What percentage of people are capable of writing a book? Let's not even worry about quality here. Let's not worry about like whether or not it's a book I would enjoy or find pleasing or that would be a bestseller or any metrics you use to decide whether or not a book is worth making / reading. But I mean, I feel like, again, it would be very generous to say 10% of the population will create a book-like thing in their lifetime, right? Okay, so that takes us from 2.5 to 0.25% of the population is capable of doing it. Then you take, in this case, like, would you be interested in writing a comic book? And it's like, okay, is 10% of the writing world interested in writing a comic book? Or, you know, willing to do it for money? Whatever. Ready, willing, and able. So I would say it's probably possible to take another 10% of that and put it in there. So what we're talking about here is like 0.03% of the population could potentially be available to write that book. And that is a tiny, tiny number of individuals, right? So here's the problem. If we want to see more diversity in literature and we want to see more diversity in books, I don't know if we're going to get there if we're also going to say, well, in order for these characters to appear, I mean, look, Colson Whitehead cannot write every book, right? Like, that is not going to happen. Roxane Gay can't write every book. Like, it's not going to work that way. So I think that that is going to be a legitimate problem. It's going to be really difficult to point to those books and to connect people with those stories that they feel are at least showing them. I mean, if you took this into another realm, I think like books and movies get compared a lot because there are some similarities here. But if you took that into a similar realm and it's like, okay, so how do we make sure that this person, you know, in a Star Wars movie is represented well? And how do we make sure this person and so on? And it's like, oh, that's going to be a tough thing to do. That's a difficult undertaking, which isn't to say that it's totally wrong. But I'm trying to be realistic about this. And the realistic side of me says, listen, are publishers going to be able to spend the time and money without going underwater to find those individuals and find enough of them to put out a super diverse lineup of literature? So I think that's one thing that I see as a legitimate problem, right? Is if you want to see diverse characters and you want to give different people different things to aspire to or to look to or to have people have those moments where they recognize themselves in literature, as far as at least demographically, you got to do it. But here's kind of the other side of that, because sure, maybe representation is, you know, beneath the need to have like accurate representation, right? But like, and this is, I guess, where I'll talk a little about my lived experience and how that works, which is I don't really see myself in a lot of media. I don't see people who I feel like I identify with. I think sometimes there's this idea that, you know, well, Captain America is a white guy, so he must be like you. And I'm like, I don't like watch Captain America and feel like that's really anything like my experience. I don't watch Thor and feel like that guy's just like me. I could be him. You know, I don't watch Ghost Rider and feel that way, even though me being Nicolas Cage is a lot more realistic than me being Thor at any point in my life. It's, you know, that's not how I feel. So I don't feel that way, even though I think sometimes other people see it that way as like, well, whatever, which is, you know, I'm trying to be understanding and not accuse anyone of saying like, so do you feel like all white people are kind of the same? Like all white guys are feel the same and want the same things, but whatever. Point being, how do you write someone outside of lived experience? You know, if you write a character, like if I write a character who's my demographics, there's probably not going to be much attack on the authenticity of that character, because anyone can assume like, well, that's his lived experience, so therefore it is culturally authentic. If a Jewish person writes a book and their family seems stereotypically Jewish, I think we have to see that as like, well, this is what, you know, that's their lived experience. So there you go. Or if it seemed not Jewish at all or differently Jewish than what we're used to, again, if the author is Jewish, it is an authentic experience, right? Their experience is authentic, even if perhaps it's not related authentically, or even if it doesn't read as authentic to an outsider. And so I guess what I'm trying to say here is like, if I were to do it, something that I would see people suggest, like if I were going to write just even a woman, you know, doesn't have to be super different for me, but just a female character, would be like, well, make sure you have female beta readers, right? To make sure that the voice is authentically female and so on and so forth. But I have to say, it's like, so I have a woman read it and they say, no, it's not authentically female and here's why. But is it not authentic to them? Or is it not authentically female? In other words, how do you get one or even a small handful of people to say this or that is authentically X? Because, you know, the women I know are probably going to be demographically similar in terms of, like, women of the world, right? Just because the people I know probably live where I live. They're probably in a similar socioeconomic status because that's how most of us live, right? So I guess what I'm saying is I don't know how you can beta read for authenticity unless the authenticity is so off base that it's like ridiculous, you know, where it's like, this is a classic example. There was an article that went up on Lit Reactor today about, so you want to write women. And I found it a little bit like, I don't know what the word I'm trying to think of is here. Patronizing, I guess. Because it's like, well, yeah, I know people do this. I know people write about women and do a terrible job. But, like, I guess I don't really need hints about how to write women better than just talking about their jugs all the time. Right? Or to say, like, women don't always refer to their breasts as jugs when they're with the doctor. Or, you know, when they get a... For example, I probably wouldn't try to write a scene of getting a pap smear, because I'd be like, eh. I mean, let's be serious. As you know on this podcast, I've had my orifices explored by medical professionals many times, but I'm like, you know, my experience is a lot more authentically butt than it is vagina. So I don't think I would write a pap smear scene just because I'd be like, you know, I really don't know. Even if different women described it to me, I don't know if I would render it correctly. I would have to need to do it for some reason. And even then, probably would be like, eh, pass. So this article, I just feel like, is a little patronizing because it's like, don't do this, don't do that. But I'm like, you're telling us the big ones. Which I'm sort of like, anyone who's reasonably concerned with writing a character with authenticity as far as their identity isn't going to do these things. Like, these are not the things that someone with good intentions is doing just by chance. This is stuff that people are doing where they're just like, I don't give a fuck. I mean, this is what I do. I'm writing it and you're reading it. That's the end. So, I guess what I'm saying is I think that a lot of people would suggest the beta reading process is the way to fix this. And I just don't know if that really works. Can you say it was authentically, you know, if I had a beta reader who was reading and it was somebody who's Mexican in my story and my beta reader was Mexican, could they say this is authentically Mexican or this is not authentically Mexican without saying to me or based on my experience? Like, I grew up and went to a school that was, I don't know, 50-50 white kids, Hispanic kids, and Hispanic kids were different. Like, it depended where they were from. It depended on their family background. You know, there were some kids who grew up with, like, white parents, and they may have had a different experience than someone who didn't, you know, or there were people who's like, it's not like they had moved here 2 days ago. They'd been here their entire lives. Their parents had been here their entire lives. So it's like, I could ask person A as a beta reader and be like, I just want you to tell me if this seems authentically Mexican to you, and person B, and they might give me totally different answers. So I think, like, beta reading, I'm not against it, and I think it's a good idea, especially to catch things that are, like, just oddly off. You know, sort of the way I guess you would do if I was writing a character who was from Boston and, you know, they use some colloquialism that I don't know about. I mean, like, we call sandwiches here a sub and they call it a hero or whatever. Then I would be like, okay, that's a little thing I caught that's going to piss off people from Boston. But I think the thing overall is that the big feeling I have is, like, I just don't think it's a great idea to tell people you shouldn't write X. And that gets into a bigger thing of, I don't think you should tell people, like, you shouldn't create art X. with X ideas or with X style or anything. Like, I think when you really cut things off that way, I just don't understand the restriction of art in the sort of infancy. In other words, like, maybe I start writing a story and maybe it is a person who's, you know, maybe it's a gay guy. But I think that to say you shouldn't do that and to say it very early on in the process kills the process, which is one thing, but then it also, how are you ever going to get there? How are you ever going to get to where you do have something that's good and meaningful and does work if you're like, well, you shouldn't even start down the road? And that's the thing, is I think that, like, this battle really does, in my opinion, happen in the publishing world more than in the writing world, because in the publishing world is where it's like people are looking at these items and saying whether or not, yes, this is worth our time to publish and put out to the world, or, you know what, no, we don't want this. We want something like this, but different. So I think that's going to be where a lot of this discussion happens and where it should happen, to be honest. But I'm not a big believer in, you know, I guess I wouldn't go to a painter and say, like, I don't think you should paint something. I don't think you should photograph something, right? Like, I don't think you should photograph people who are of a different race than you, or, like, try to tell their story through photos. Because I guess I just feel like, A, well, when are we going to see diversity? Like, how is that going to happen? It's not going to be enough. But B, I don't know. People should create things and just create more things. And the more things that are created, it's fine. We'll just sift through them. That's kind of what we've always done, right? Is sifted through things that are good and bad. And as far as, like, if you read a novel and it has a, you know, black male character and you're like, so whoever wrote this thinks that black people talk like, you know, a rap skit from a Wu-Tang album, then obviously you're going to say, you know what, I think I'm going to pass on this one. But I guess, I don't know. I think the idea of an authentic X experience, you know, fill in with race, gender, orientation, is kind of a weird one. Because I think there are experiences that when they're committed to paper can seem inauthentic, right? I think it's like most people would look at that and say, I don't know, this seems like a push. It seems a little bit like a stretch. But I don't think that there's really a line for, like, well, this seems very authentic, other than it's what someone has lived. So I don't know. I mean, in talking it out, maybe I'd have to say my opinion is that, like, if authenticity is the most important thing to you as a reader, then yeah, I guess you're going to have to read books that have characters who are of the person who wrote them, who have lived their experiences and, like, you know, have felt those things, I guess. But I don't know. I guess I'm not interested in that. And part of me likes to discourage that too, just because I think looking into the author of something is a weird activity. I find it a weird activity that people look into who made something in order to figure out whether or not it's good. Because it's like, I sort of feel like with a novel, like, shouldn't you just read it and it's either good or it's not? And I know that's not how it works, again, with, like, publishing and marketing and so on. And merit is, like, the most impossible thing to quantify. So that's obviously not going to work on that level. But on a personal level, I think you can know whether you're reading something and enjoying it and feeling good about it, or reading something and feeling like, holy shit, this seems crazy or out there or inauthentic to me. And that's the last thing I'll say about it, is I think that authenticity is kind of come into this thing of identity politics and literature where it's an on-off switch. So in other words, like, if if an author has bad politics, fuck it, I'm not reading their book. Or if book X has something objectionable in it, fuck it, I'm not reading it. Whereas I kind of think that maybe authenticity and these other things, authorship, should be questions that do feed into an overall how I felt about a book, but should be a category, just like, you know, was the dialogue good? Was the plotting good? Did it feel like there was a bunch of extra stuff in the book that didn't need to be in the book? So on and so forth, right? Like, there's a bunch of these kinds of factors in a book. And I think that the authenticity and the, you know, whether or not it lines up with sort of diversity initiatives and things should be a category, but not the category. Or this is how I feel for me. I mean, people are free to read however the fuck they want. So if you want to read and that's an on-off switch for you, like, that's cool. And I don't really have a problem with that, because it's kind of like everyone's got to make their decisions on how to see stuff, right? If people want to decide, like, I'm never seeing a movie that doesn't pass the Bechdel test, that's fine. Like, whatever. I mean, I guess I don't feel like I have a horse in that race. I just feel like, well, I was asked the question of how I feel about it, and this is how I feel about it. But something about my feelings is that I don't feel that the way I feel is necessarily correct, or the only way, or the best way. It's just how I feel. But I just wanted to talk about it on here, because I think that when issues like this come up, it seems like you'll basically get two sides of it, and they're the two extremes. And they're like I talked about before, the defensive side of things because they've done it, or, you know, they've seen their book sales fuck off because they've done it or whatever. And then other people who feel like it's kind of the end all be all, like it's the most important thing ever. And usually you don't get to hear from someone who doesn't have a hot take. I would say I have a, you know, mediocre, lukewarm oatmeal for breakfast take on it, which is like, it's a take. And an hour later, you'll be hungry for a different, more meaty take, probably. But that's life. I don't know. Maybe you should be listening to Roman Mars, if that's how you feel about things. God damn you, Roman Mars. That would have been a good, solid ending to put on it, but of course I have to say a couple other things, or, you know, I have a couple other things to say. I guess I don't have to say anything, right? We don't have to do any of this, but I'm going to, and I'm going to keep going. I do think one of the other problems with the idea of only writing from lived experience is, you know, we talked a lot last election stuff about bubbles, right? Like, we all kind of live in our comfy bubbles, and we mostly talk to people who think the way we do, you know, or look the way we do, or act the way we do, or, right, friends, basically. And I guess probably, you know, the world being more online and more global kind of shows us in more obvious terms that, like, our friends tend to look and be a lot like us. This may have been true before, but it wasn't, A, so obvious, and B, it was kind of like, well, if I'm living in Colorado and most of my friends kind of look like me and they live where I live and similar status and stuff, it's like, well, you know, I just don't meet a lot of other people. But now it's, I think, more obvious, or there's a different version of this, right? So we talked a lot about our bubbles. And I kind of agree with the bubble theory that, like, we would probably do well to branch out and talk to some other people who aren't like us, right? I kind of think that encouraging people to only write from lived experience reinforces the idea of the bubble. Because it's like, you're living, again, in your bubble. I mean, that's literally, not only are you living in your bubble, but you're reliving in your bubble. you're kind of talking about feelings and things from the perspective of your bubble. Like, everything is, it's another instance of not people, it's sort of like people aren't trying to continue living in their bubble. They're trying to go out, and someone's pushing them back into the bubble. I hate saying the word bubble this much. It's like getting on my nerves. But I think I went and saw Kevin Smith talk one time, and it wasn't at all in this context, but it did motivate me a little bit. And I felt like one thing he said was very true, which is like, people will see you in a box, right? They'll see you as being a certain way. And there's just this sort of natural inclination on the part of most people. If someone tries to get out of their box, there's kind of this natural inclination to shove them back in. And it's sometimes it's harsh and whatever, but it's not always aggressive. It's not always because they hate you. It's just because that's how they see you. And it's sort of like reconciling the world as you see it with the world as it is. And so sometimes it's easier to say, like, no. He was talking about it in the context of being a filmmaker, right? And when he was living near his home and hanging out with the people he always hung out with, and they didn't see him as a filmmaker. But it's because he wasn't a filmmaker to them. He was, you know, Kevin Smith. He was that kid. He was the fat kid who lived down the street and, you know, was weird or whatever. Quit his job at Domino's to go see Batman. So I think that this is a little bit like that. It's a little bit like, well, hey, you're not X, and therefore let's push you back into your box. Because that's where, not where you're comfortable, that doesn't come into the equation, but it's where we are comfortable with you existing. If you never go outside your box, you'll never experience being pushed back into your box, right? This is kind of relates to a column I pitched that I hope I'll get to write, which is about writing when you live in the place where you grew up. Because, you know, writing, a lot of people talk about travel and experiencing other things, but I think there are things you experience by staying put that you don't experience when you move around. You don't get to just remake yourself when you stay put. Because there's always someone who remembers when you peed your pants in kindergarten or whatever. And like, you can't just, that just doesn't cease to exist, because as far as anyone knows, that never happened. So it's kind of, it becomes up to you when you leave a place to remake yourself or not, or to tell people about those things and that kind of stuff. But when you stay put, that the remaking and stuff is not your choice. You don't have control over it. You don't control things the way you do. Anyway, point being, I think it's damaging in the bubble sense, because I think it's bad to reinforce the bubble and the sort of way we've interacted in terms of bubbles, but also because I think that it's like it's an instance of people trying to shove people back into the box, and I'm sort of resistant to that naturally, I think, which is like, I think people should be able to move outside of their box and see what's out, see what else is out there if they want to. The other thing, this is kind of a, this is probably the harshest critique of it, but I have to say I see a lot of critique coming, a lot of critique of people writing outside their personal lived experience comes from people who would benefit if we were only writing from lived experience. So in other words, it's people who would benefit if it was, we were only allowed to write from our lived experience, because they have lived experiences that are not well represented, right? And this is a very, I understand, harsh critique, because basically what I'm saying is like, well, of course you would say that, because that makes it easier for you to get your books published. That gives you a leg up. Because as you see it, well, now I've basically cornered a market. Or I've made a market much, much smaller. Let's put it that way. I mean, there's nothing you can do to make publishing easy. I'm not under that illusion. But I'm also not making the mistake of thinking, well, hey, I can see a personal benefit here. Like, and that's the thing, is I do think it's hard to hear this from someone who I can immediately see where they get a personal benefit, right? It's hard for me to take what they're saying as even remotely objective, which it totally might be. I will give people that much leeway to say, yeah, they might be objective about it. They might not actually benefit from it personally, or, you know, it might whatever. But it's tough for me to not hear what they're saying and also hear a voice in my head saying, you know, this individual who's saying we should only write from lived experience and people who haven't lived experience shouldn't tread on that ground, it's hard for me to not notice that what they're saying is also a little bit like carving out their own turf. And carving it out in such a way that others will then defend their turf, right? So if someone is saying you can only write from lived experience, and if others agree with this, then they will defend your turf from other writers potentially talking about things that you want to talk about, or, you know, publishers will be forced to seek you out if they want to publish a book about X. And I think that this is, well, I think this is difficult in a few ways, but I do want to say, too, that it's not necessarily realistic in ways. For example, if we're talking about something historical, if we're talking about, you know, if you're talking about World War II, there's not going to be a lot of people who lived through World War II. So do I think that, like, a combat veteran of the Iraq War might be better suited to write about combat in World War II? Perhaps. I mean, they would certainly have some experiences that would lend something to what they were saying. But do I think others should be barred from doing it, or, you know, culturally barred? Of course I'm not saying that no one's going to make a law, no one's going to do anything like that. But I think we just need to be thoughtful about this. I think we need to consider, like, to whose benefit it is to tell people not to write about something. Is that to everyone's benefit? Is it more beneficial that people only write from lived experience? Or is it more beneficial to open it up and then gauge what we can best determine is authentic or not once the product exists? Because really, I think that's one of the, again, one of the factors that determines whether or not something is quote unquote good, is if you have a movie that has children in it, do they seem like actual children? Do they seem authentically like children? Or does it just seem to you like an adult writing what a child would say? This happens a lot in comics, right? Like, I will read comics and then I feel bad critiquing them because I'm like, they're intended for children. And children, I don't know if children can pick up on this as well as adults can. I really, because I don't remember thinking this as a child. But as an adult, sometimes you read something like a comic that's intended for a younger audience and you think, man, this really sounds like an adult trying to write like a child. And I don't mean trying to be like cool and hip, you know, hello fellow students kind of way, because that's very, very obvious most of the time. I just mean in a way where you sort of feel like, I think this is an adult writing a book that they wish kids would read and hear the message of, rather than something that they are interested in reading. And I don't know, maybe kids aren't as savvy to that as adults are. And so maybe it's kind of no harm, no foul, but it's hard to say. But again, it's like, okay, so lived experience would allow you to write for children or write child characters having been a child, right? But it doesn't necessarily leave room, because, you know, I guess the other thing is we're mostly talking culturally, right? But it doesn't leave room for the fantastical, really. I mean, because nobody... Has anyone gone to a wizarding school? No. Nobody has done that. So how does that fit into this idea? It really doesn't. I mean, it's really just kind of saying, it's weirdly, when you put it into that context, it's saying, well, if J.K. Rowling had written, she shouldn't have written Harry Potter as Harry Potter, because she did not authentically live the life of a young boy, right? She was a young girl. And so that was probably incorrect. But that is really more egregious in this sense than writing about a wizarding school. Or it's less authentic than her interpretation of a wizarding school. And I guess the reason, you know, as I'm talking it out here is because, well, wizarding schools don't exist, so there's really no such thing as an inauthentic wizarding school. But I think the very idea of a wizarding school is probably inauthentic, right? Or, you know, another way to look at this is, I mean, she came from poverty, right? So she can authentically write about what it was like for Harry Potter to live in a sort of poverty-esque situation. But then the way she got out of poverty was by writing Harry Potter books, and that helped her get out of the situation she was in, right? Whereas Harry Potter just, like, went to the bank, and his parents had put away a bunch of money for him, and he was just like, oh, well, the way for him to not be poor anymore was to get money. And so it's like, yeah, I mean, she didn't, that was inauthentic, right? Because that's not what happened to her. So there's some interesting factors here. And yeah, I think about too, if you think about a Harry Potter and you think about something like that where you have an ensemble cast of characters, it's like, well, should all the characters then come from the author's experience? Because then they are all going to be pretty the same, right? They're all going to be samey. And is that what we want? Like, do we want characters who look different and sound different and think differently and have different orientations and so on and so forth? Or do we want lived experience to be the guiding force? So yeah, I can just sum it up again that way, which is I think lived experience and authenticity. I think authenticity is really what we're talking about, or what we should be talking about, as opposed to lived experience. I think lived experience is a path to authenticity, but I don't think that it's the only path, and I don't necessarily think we should be looking to it as the primary path. As my good friend and mentor Tom would say it, fiction is the lie that tells the truth truer. So in other words, a fictional character can do something that relates an experience through false things, right? So I understand the experience of a gay man living in New York better through the lies that Tom told about it. Because they were authentic. But they didn't have to be lived experience necessarily. And that, I guess that's part of it too, is Tom's thing is always like, you write from the sore place, right? And so that probably will be your lived experience, but the way you express it may not be through lived experience, and the way you expressed it may be authentic without being factually true, or maybe authentic without being accurate. The emotions, the ideas, these things resonate with people, even if they're not, you know, totally factual. Even if things were blended to create a different scene, to explain something, or to make, you can shape reality to be more real, to feel more real than it was. This is a little bit too like when people, it's sort of the fictional version of, you'll be reading a nonfiction book and it might say something at the beginning of like, a couple characters were combined for clarity, some conversations were combined, or, you know, I remembered these conversations to the best of my ability, but and transcribed quotes were taken and transcribed and then written to be clear as opposed to being 100% accurate. So in other words, accurate to what they were trying to say as opposed to being accurate to the exact words they used or rephrasings or ums and uhs and so on, right? This is the fictional version of doing that, is writing the authentic feeling, the authentic event, even if authenticity and accuracy or crystal clear exactly as the event happened isn't the same sort of thing. I just saw part of this show, and it wasn't very good, but there was something that was interesting because they were talking about security camera footage and as far as criminal cases, and it's like, well, security footage is kind of like the end-all be-all, right? But this person was saying you really have to interrogate footage the way you would interrogate a witness. So in other words, for example, quick example they showed was, depending on how many frames per second your camera captures, it showed footage of a guy firing a gun, right? And he's like, so this camera captures 2 muzzle flashes, but this camera that has more frames per second captures 3, and this one captures 4. So what you might have on video is 2 muzzle flashes indicating 2 shots fired, but in reality, 4 shots were fired. So you have to look at the frames per second and thereby interrogate what the camera is saying in order to figure out what really happened. So just because what you're seeing is there isn't what really happened. And I liked that. I mean, that was an interesting way to look at fiction as well, which is like, okay, what's depicted isn't what really happened, but that's always on purpose. That's crafted in terms of fiction, right? As opposed to just being a technological limitation. I guess all this to say that overall my opinion is no, we shouldn't be telling writers what to write, especially based on this or that, because I understand it's one thing, but it's like each different individual has something that bothers them. I had a coworker who had a very close family member who passed away from cancer. And, you know, after that, it was like, it seems like cancer's coming up everywhere, right? Every movie you watch, every book you read, it's cancer, cancer, cancer. Couldn't take the cancer narratives. And, you know, the cancer narratives, a lot of them didn't ring true. And also, it was just like, I mean, obviously, this is going to be a very loaded subject for her for a while, maybe forever. Does that mean we should tell people not to do that? No. I mean, that doesn't mean that these things shouldn't exist. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to write these stories. It just means that for someone who did live it, yeah, it's not accurate. It might not feel authentic. It might feel like a tool or a crutch that's being used in a story, and it really shouldn't be that way. But I guess I feel strongly that it doesn't mean we should tell people not to do something. It feels a little bit too like telling people not to do that is like, you know, there's a dead end road and someone chooses to walk down the road and they don't know whether or not there's a dead end there, and you're passing them by and don't know whether or not they know, but they're not in distress. They seem to have hiking supplies. They're going to just walk down the road, and it's like, well, could you tell them, like, give them some tips or tell them, like, there is a dead end to this road? Perhaps. But should you forbid them from walking down the road because it leads to a dead end? I say no. People should, you know, and just because something didn't work out doesn't mean that it was a wasted exercise. Just because a book someone's writing doesn't work out for reasons of authenticity doesn't mean they shouldn't write it. And in fact, it might be living through that experience and going through that experience that teaches them about authenticity, or perhaps teaches them that, hey, this is what I should write about, or teaches them how to do other things. I mean, that's not going to be the only thing that tanks a book or not, right? Or it's not going to be the only thing that they learn from the project is an authenticity lesson. And, you know, that's, I would feel the same way about somebody writing someone who's like me. And if I read it and I was like, well, this is very inauthentic. And I will say there are depictions of people like me that I find very inauthentic. But I can understand where they're coming from sometimes. I don't usually think either it's because no one has ever met someone like me. That seems very statistically unlikely. But sometimes I feel like I see characters who are demographically like me, and they're written in a certain way because I think there's some catharsis going on here, or maybe some spirit of the staircase of, like, I wish that's what was said. Or sometimes someone in a book who looks and is kind of like me will say really stupid shit because I think that opens up a platform for someone else in the book to say something really smart, or something that expresses a different view, right? And that's fine. Like, that exists, and that's fine, and it's not, it doesn't read to me as authentic, but I would never tell someone, no, you can't do that. I would never say to somebody, that's not allowed. If I can use an example from workshop, someone brought to workshop last year a story, and I talked about it on here, I think, and it was a story about somebody who was a maid who was like a topless maid service, right? And basically, the way they talked about it, there were a couple people. There was somebody in the class who had done that and worked as like a stripper, I believe, or a sex worker of some kind, and was basically saying, like, well, this and that doesn't ring true to me. Specifically, I think there was a line in the story about how, like, none of the guys that this person worked for ever got pervy or tried to touch it or push things or anything like that, and kind of set them up as sympathetic characters. And the person was like, no, that it just doesn't work that way. Like, if you're going to work in this way, you got to be tough and you got to be good at enforcing the boundaries, because they are not going to all be polite and not want you to do things that you're like, you didn't pay for that, right? And this was probably good. However, I think it was good that he wrote this and found this out. I think it was good that he got that feedback. I think he probably learned a lot from receiving that feedback and processing it and taking it the way he did. He didn't take it well. But I also think a lot of us in the class learned from watching him receive and take this feedback, how to take feedback, and how to do these things. And maybe this is part of the problem, is because being part of these workshop situations throughout my life, I kind of see authenticity as one factor, you know, where someone else will be criticized just as hard for something else. For, you know, I saw someone take a pretty harsh critique in that workshop for basically having a story where, like, that was boring, where nothing really happened. And it was hard to take, and it was hard to listen to, and it was just like, oof, this is harsh, but not incorrect. Factually accurate, but not incorrect. And I guess that's the thing, is that it's sort of like I've been saying, one of many things that can go wrong, but I don't think it should be something that we don't do because it could go wrong. You know, I don't think this person who wrote the story that was essentially boring shouldn't have written that story because it turned out boring. And I don't think they shouldn't have brought it to workshop. I think they did the right thing bringing it to workshop. When you bring things to workshop, or you bring things to an editor, or you bring things to someone, it's like, it's good if they're not perfect, because that gives you things to work on. That's kind of the whole point. So what's my whole point in this whole rambly thing? I would just sum it up as, I don't think that any of us should be in the business of telling artists not to do something. Not to do something in a style, not to pursue a project, not to do anything like that. And I think that I personally plan to move forward in life, availing myself of work and doing my level best to read things, watch things, experience things, and enjoy them on their merits, as opposed to finding out everything about the author first, or the authenticity of it, or the lived experience of it first. And then deciding whether or not I enjoyed it, whether or not I felt it was authentic, so on and so forth. I would prefer to experience the things and then like them or not. And if I felt they were inauthentic or I felt they were this or that, then yeah, of course, I might look into it more. But honestly, if I didn't enjoy something or felt that it just didn't speak to me or whatever, I probably am not going to waste any time on it. I'm not going to spend much time figuring out why I didn't like it. Like, I just kind of want to... Well, yes, I will. Of course I will, in my head and possibly on here. But I try not to go that route, because I think it's easy. I think it's very easy to dislike a book, flip to the back, look at the author and say, well, there you go. I mean, I think Chuck Palahniuk is a gay man... has written some very authentic, masculine, straight characters and has not lived that experience, right? But I think he, like with Fight Club especially, wrote a book that gets at the core of what masculinity is, what it means to men, and, you know, like what it means to straight men. It speaks to them. Obviously, it speaks to them based on the crowds it's been adopted by, both the people who interpret it and misinterpret it. And so I think that that's really what I want to get at here, is we're going to miss things like that if people are only permitted to do things from their lived experience. We are going to miss out on a lot of great stuff, or stuff will never be created, if that's one of the criteria we're using to decide whether or not something is worthy of existing. And I don't even mean marketing. I don't mean publishing. It's like, I 100% agree. It's like, if you're a publisher and you want to publish a great novel about immigration from Central America, I would highly advise that you try and find somebody who's lived that experience, right? But if you aren't doing that, I think it's fine to see what's out there and look around at what's out there. And I think it would be great if people put more of their marketing effort behind these lived experience type books and that kind of thing. And if that's what people want, then of course it makes a lot of sense to put your marketing behind that. But at the same time, I don't think that on the creating, writing side, we should really be having this debate. I think it needs to just be more about, like, well, hey, is a good amount of your effort going to truly diversifying your lineup? Good. If not, I don't think it's the fault of people who are submitting manuscripts to your publisher, or people who are reading them and saying, I like this book or that book. I think you need to look more at, are you offering a good amount of other things, and are you putting the right amount of effort into those things as well? So there you go. That probably sums it all up in basically what's like almost an entire second episode. But hey, it's a complicated issue. And of course, like, I'm trying to get over it, but as most people, I think, I don't want people to think that I'm, like, a horrific racist. So you gotta talk about it. It takes a little bit more splaining, I suppose, to be like, say how you really feel about something, as opposed to a snippy tweet. So that's my thing. I don't want to do a snippy tweet about it. I want to tell you how I really feel about it. And I guess if you still feel like I'm a horrific racist, well, I'm surprised you listened this far. All right. Well, that's all. That really is all this time. I'll see you next time. Hey, everybody. So, everything in the episode that preceded this I recorded yesterday. And then I kind of thought... I had some other thoughts. I guess I wanted to talk just for a second about why I felt the way I did. Because afterwards I was like, well, why do you care? You know what I mean? Like, why do you care about this? Or why do you have strong feelings about this that you wanted to share? So I'm sharing it now. Also in the car again, although now it's raining. So hopefully that's not crazy loud and distracting, but we'll see what happens. We'll see if audio magic can happen. But I did want to talk just a little bit more. I mean, I feel like I wrapped it up like 10 times and then thought about it some more and thought, well, what do I really want to say? And what I really wanted to do wasn't wrap it up, but I think introduce things differently. So maybe I'll throw this at the beginning. Maybe I'll throw this at the end. I don't know. But what I wanted to talk about is why I have the feelings I have, and it's in a very broad general sense, but it's, I think, really well summarized by an experience I had a few years ago, which was on a work team, with somebody who I got along with for a long time, and then on this work team we really didn't get along. And it was a weird thing for me, because I have to say, generally I get along with people really well at work. I think I've got a pretty healthy sense of, like, preserving the relationship versus getting the work done. And in my work environment, like, preserving the relationship is as important, if not more important, probably. Just because it's, like, any individual task we're doing probably isn't of, like, crazy importance most of the time. So we had to kind of come up with this structure for something, and there was a weird power dynamic, because this person was now in charge of the project / responsible for the project, but and I think she did something that a lot of people do with projects like this, which is they think they want a lot of input and a lot of other ideas, but they don't. But something that I'll say about this person is that this was one of my first encounters with somebody who I would say was not a creative person. And I have this definition I came up with of creative and uncreative people. And it's specifically someone who's not creative, but finds themselves in a sort of creative role or doing a task that requires creative thinking. The way I define a creative person is they are able to see things as other than the way that they initially imagine them. And she was not able to do that. The way that she conceived of something, the way that she saw something working or existing, became the correct way for her. And other ways were incorrect. They weren't just not as good. They were incorrect and kind of offensive that they existed at all, as opposed to just being different ways of looking at something. And I wouldn't say that she was an unempathetic person. I think she could see some things from someone else's perspective, but I think she really didn't understand or was kind of afraid of the idea of creative thinking. And the reason I say that, too, is because what she was constantly trying to do was codify creative thought or creative process. So in other words, like, well, how can we take a creative process, how can we take creativity, codify it, turn it into a process, and make it something that uncreative people can do? And I just felt like that was kind of a silly goal or kind of an impossible goal. I mean, we tried. We tried really hard, and we got so far, but in the end it didn't really matter. And it was kind of through this process that I started to think that maybe, yeah, maybe that is the problem. Maybe the problem is if you try to do a creative thing and take the creativity out of it, it's probably just not going to work. You're probably not going to get what you want. And I don't think that you can do that. I think that there's also, though, no harm in trying. And I think that, you know, there's a whole cottage industry of things that try to do this, right? Like, you'll read these. I checked out this book from the library the other day that was, like, the morning routines of a bunch of creative people. But I've kind of, you know, experimented with this stuff and rallied against a lot of it, which is, like, look, Einstein wore the same clothes every day, so he didn't have to think about his clothes. But me not having to think about my clothes doesn't make me Einstein. Right? Now, hey, maybe you hear that and it sounds like a good idea and go for it. Like, I'm all for that. Like, try it out, see what happens. But whatever you're trying to do, you know, if you're, like, trying to write a novel, it's probably good if you spend a small amount of your time replicating the tools or practices as far as, like, do they write in the morning? Do they do this? As opposed to spending time writing the book. Because you could live the exact life of Mary Oliver other than the writing part. If you replicate everything other than the writing, you still are not going to be writing like Mary Oliver at the end of the day. And the person who has a routine nothing like Mary Oliver, but, you know, works on the writing part, is probably going to be closer. But here's the thing. I think it's harmless to do that stuff. It's potentially helpful to people. So I don't have a problem with it. The problem I have with it is when people try and take creativity and then apply rules to it that make sense to them. So in other words, when you take some art or you take some creative process and you try and sort of work creative types through the machine that you have designed for yourself, and maybe it works for you, or maybe you're a creative person who needs a very strict process, but most people you'll find who are creative will say, like, here's what works for me, but it's not for everybody. That's kind of like the constant chorus of creatives is like, well, here's what I do, but I mean, that's not what other people do, and there's other people who make way better shit than I do. So, I don't know. You should probably ask them, and you just need to figure out what works for you, right? But so this very uncreative person, I mean, it got ugly at work. Got a little ugly there for a while. And I really think it has a lot to do with the fact that I just, in many ways, tried to express that I think that what she was trying to do wasn't a great idea. And to try and make creativity to try and put it in a bottle, I think is a mistake and an overreach. And this part I didn't share with her, but she was not the right person for that job. Because it's like, well, that's like asking someone to bottle the formula for Coca-Cola who has no taste buds. I mean, how are they ever going to replicate a formula if they can't even tell whether or not they've succeeded? So anyway, that's kind of one thing, because I do feel like this is the application of rules and process that mostly come from the consumer end. Sort of, it's application of rules to creative people, and they're rules that can be understood by non-creative people. So in other words, I can flip to the back of a book and look at an author photo and see whether or not lived experience is likely. And I think that's kind of an interesting... That's something I am against. I am against the sort of idea that, like, well, we should be trying to create things so that they're easily absorbed and critiqued by uncreative people. And, you know, I think the other thing, the big one, and it's like, I'm not going to make any direct comparisons here, but I think we often tend to forget, or we tend to ignore when it's convenient, that a lot of creative things were very transgressive in their time. A lot of the art we love, a lot of the things that we enjoy were very transgressive and broke the rules. And now we don't see it as much because it's like, well, it was a rule at that time, but it's not a rule anymore. But at the time, there are a lot of these creative things that really, really broke the rules, broke the laws, and whether we're talking about art or, you know, what I would put as heroism or things like that, very transgressive in their time. So whenever I see a rule like this, it makes me think, well, what's the transgression against that rule? And will the transgression against that rule eventually be the thing that we see as a good thing to have done? Or, you know, will there be art that is transgressive but good enough? Or, you know, good enough despite its transgression, or good enough because of its transgression, that then we say, okay, you know, this isn't the end-all be-all. This isn't the way to critique art anymore. Like, this isn't what we're going to do. And I think that's what scares me about these sorts of things, where it's putting these pass-fail type rules on something, and they're rules that occur before the thing has been absorbed. So in other words, lived experience. You can tell before you've read the book whether or not it is lived experience, and therefore be looking at it through a lens of, well, did this person succeed in recreating an experience that they didn't live? Or did this person who lived this experience render this accurately? And those are different lenses, right? And so what my fear is with things like this is that what we will do is we'll stop looking at things like a book and say, well, was it good? Was it good enough in some other way, or did it succeed in providing an authentic experience? Or is that what I'm looking for? Is that what this book was about? All these things, right? My fear is that we'll stop reading books and saying, like, you know, it was bad in this way but good in this way, and here's the overall experience as a result of the sum of those things. And instead, we'll just stop reading those things. Because it's like, I'm never going to read that because I know where it came from. And that's too much for me. And that's just throwing us back in the bubble again, right? That's just saying, I'm not even going to avail myself of an experience because I know the origin of the person who's relating the experience isn't of the experience. And that's just tough. I think that's tough to think about. And that's not something that I like to think about. I don't like to think that things would be that way, that we would not be open to some of these options. Which is why, you know, of course, I think the answer is both. I think the answer, if we're going to talk solutions-based, is both. Like, yeah, we got to do some and we got to do the other. So you got to do the authentic and you got to do the inauthentic, the lived and the not lived. All right. We'll see you for next time. For real this time.